Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. This is John Tippett with the Firefighter Near Miss Reporting System. I also work as a battalion chief in Montgomery County, Maryland, and this is the second edition of Near Miss Listen and Learn. I want to say thanks to Firehouse.com for making this podcast a reality. This edition, we're going to be joined by Christine Booth from the International Association of Fire Chiefs as our report reader. And we're going to be looking at some case studies from the National Firefighter Near Miss Reporting System. Website is firefighternearmiss.com. The reports this month or this edition are going to be based on exertion and exhaustion on the training ground and fire ground. Today's reports can be found by using the search reports feature found on the homepage at firefighternearmiss.com. The homepage search reports tab will take you to a keyword function where you can type in heat exhaustion and training, and you can also widen the number of reports searched by just typing in heat exhaustion in that keyword search box. Well, as everyone knows, we're entering into the dog days of summer. Firefighters from California to Connecticut are dealing with operating in sweltering conditions. Our thoughts are with all those firefighters on the wildfire lines out in the west, and also with firefighters that are dealing with flooding in the middle of the country as well. So carrying on that committed to long-term results theme from last month's Safety, Health, and Survival Week, this edition we're going to address the heat exhaustion issues that occur on the training ground and the fire ground. We're all well aware of the effects of heat on the body when we're actively engaged in firefighting activities, and also one unique report that deals with rescue activities. A number of forces will conspire to multiply the heat effect. As you all know, our bodies strive to maintain a relatively specific temperature for optimal function. Maintaining that temperature is achieved a number of ways. The first thing we notice or that we'll see is that blood is diverted to the skin surface to help dissipate heat. That's that flushing sensation that you notice in people. One of the other things that will happen is you'll start to breathe harder, expelling heat with the exhaled air. However, the most important function or mechanism that we have to get rid of heat is to perspire. Everybody, I think, is pretty much well aware that when we work, the muscles of our body generate heat. The amount of heat produced increases in hot weather. The body's thermostat, or the hypothalamus, regulates that core temperature and works hard to keep it at a relatively small range. The temperature reaches that set point, and the hypothalamus sends messages to the skin to release fluids, which we know is perspiration, salts, and other components. And those go through the pores of the skin and to maintain that all-important viable core temperature of around 98.6 or so. The human body doesn't tolerate more than a few degrees above its core temperature before the adverse effects of heat are felt. Perspiration moves out to the outer surface of the skin where it evaporates as air currents flow over it. That carries the heat away and allows the body to maintain that temperature. And everything starts to go a little awry when the body can neither sufficiently cool itself, and that's the difference between the skin temperature and the ambient temperature too close, or the air temperature itself exceeds the skin temperature, or the body runs out of fluid. You get a reduced blood volume because of dehydration. The results of these situations are commonly known as heat stress, heat prostration. They go by heat exhaustion, and then there's that very dangerous situation of heat stroke. The barriers that impede good heat dissipation for us include the insufficient hydration, that's the leading cause, encapsulating the body, which for our purposes will be enclosing ourselves in our PPE envelope, and exposing the body to temperatures that are hotter than can be regulated, such as we encounter during ambient fire conditions and then periods of high humidity. So the impact of firefighting on these situations is relatively obvious, I think, to all of us, but often they get ignored for a variety of reasons. We get engrossed in our work. We don't pay attention to our own fitness levels. We don't listen to what our bodies are telling us as far as needing fluids. And this edition's reports are going to serve as reminders to be on the lookout for all of those conditions. So just a final note here before we jump into the reports, that the narrator of the reports is not the report submitter. And in most cases, the report has been condensed for the purposes of our podcast today. So, if we get into the first report, we're going to be talking about heat exhaustion in training. And just as a reminder, NFPA standard 1403 is the guide that we use for live burns. It's a standard that's been out there for probably well over 25 years now and should be the standard that all fire departments use when they look to burn in acquired structures. But this is also a reminder that 1403 can also provide you with an exceptional template that you can use for training in any acquired structure. So you don't necessarily have to set the place on fire to have to look at 1403 for some good background and information on how to set the structure up. This first report is number 06530. It comes to us from a firefighter in a mostly volunteer combination department in FEMA Region 6. The event took place in October, about 4 hours into the shift, at about 2,100 hours. And I'm going to turn it over to Christine to give us the information on the report.
Members from two departments are conducting training for new cadets at a local burn building. About 10 to 14 evolutions were scheduled. The first 3 to 4 went smoothly until the chief of one department sustained minor burns. He retired for the night and left stokers with 0 to 2 years of experience in charge of the remaining evolutions. Subsequent burns grew in intensity until the cadets and firefighters were damaging their gear. After stoking for several hours, with 30 minutes of work and 10 minutes of rest, including hydration, I began feeling dizzy and incredibly warm. The safety officer and another firefighter stripped off my gear because I was too exhausted to do it myself. I sustained first-degree burns and heat exhaustion. My lessons learned? Don't allow inexperienced, highly motivated firefighters to lead training burns. Destroying PPE during training burns is dangerous. And as a senior firefighter, I should have taken charge of the training burn.
Thanks, Christine. As we take a review back over the report, we'll notice that the firefighter, the reporter in this particular incident, was working as a stoker. And as we've seen in some of the more tragic NIOSH reports about line-of-duty deaths of instructors, the instructors work for extended periods. They take some period of rest and try to rehydrate in that brief period of time. But it doesn't seem, what typically happens is you can't get yourself rehydrated to recover what's going on for what you've sweated away and also replace your blood volume in sufficient time with that short period of rest. So one of the things we want to suggest is that there be a rotation of instructors so that the instructors get a longer work break. And also, as the firefighter or the reporter point out here, that the you can become so overheated that you're too exhausted to even remove your turnout gear, and somebody else will have to take care of that for you. So it points to the figure that during training evolutions, somebody has to maintain good accountability and control, good command and control at the scene there. Safety officers need to pay attention to what's going on. And then, at the very least, we should be wary of the fact that if we're burning in structures and we're starting to damage protective clothing, that we've probably gone beyond the pale when it comes to what would be considered a good training program. So let's look at our next report. And our next report is 06386. It was submitted in July of 2006. It comes to us from a lieutenant in a volunteer department in FEMA Region 7. This particular event did take place at the height of the summer in July of 2006. And I'll turn it back over to Christine.
A department is performing search and rescue training in an acquired structure. The assistant chief is in charge of the exercise, and the weather is about 80 degrees with 80% humidity, and the house is closed up, so the temperature inside the house is even hotter. Suddenly, a firefighter's low air alarm went off. The firefighter stood up and said, "I'm too hot. I can't take it anymore," and tried to exit. The assistant chief told the firefighter he wasn't going anywhere until the victim was removed. The firefighter collapsed after exiting the building with the victim. The firefighter was treated for heat exhaustion on the scene. My lessons learned? This was a training exercise. If the firefighter had any medical problems, he could have died. Our SOGs state that if your low air alarm sounds, the team exits and the backup team makes entry to finish the job. SOGs are in place to protect firefighters. They need to be followed by everyone.
Okay. In this particular exercise or report, we go right to the crux of the issue when it comes to training. People become sort of wrapped up in what's going on with the exercise. They lose sight of the fact that it is a training exercise, and they don't pay attention to exactly what's going on with the firefighters around them. They push so hard for that, accomplish the mission, get it done, try to force people to take the heat, which is something that we should have probably be moving away from or have moved away from quite a while ago. If a firefighter is in the midst of a training exercise and they say they're too hot and they can't take it anymore, that's certainly an indication that something has gone awry and they need to be removed from the structure as soon as possible. Find out what the source of the issue is, and then they can participate in the training again. To have a firefighter be forced to remain in a situation to the point of collapse just goes beyond what we would be considering a good training practice or even a good approach to teaching people how to do the job. About this time, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back to you in just about a minute.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
It is still not too late to make your arrangements to attend Fire Rescue International in Denver this August. Join us there for the free pre-conference sessions on Tuesday, August 12th and Wednesday, August 13th. This interactive two-day workshop will use crew resource management and a human factors analysis tool to analyze near-miss reports. To register for this session and for more information about Fire Rescue International, please visit iafc.org/FRI. Free training on how to implement the near-miss reporting system in your department, plus facilitated case study reviews, is available by contacting nearmiss@iafc.org. Take advantage of this benefit from the grant that funds the near-miss program to provide your members with an opportunity to learn strategies to promote using the system and learn from selected case studies to improve safety. That email address again is nearmiss@iafc.org.
Okay, we're back and we're going to transition to the second portion of our podcast. And this time we're going to spend the rest of we're going to spend the duration of the podcast talking about heat exhaustion during incident operations. Our first report is 06489. It comes to us from September 2006. Was submitted from a firefighter in a paid municipal department in FEMA Region 4. And the event took place in July, about 19:30 hours. Just a word here, with the way the reports come in, there is no statute of limitations on reports, and as is demonstrated by this account, the incident occurred back in July, and the firefighter submitted the report in September. So we're happy to have the report, and I'm going to turn things over to Christine to do a read on the narrative.
I responded while off-duty to a fire in an auto repair shop. The weather was hot. I bunkered out and entered the building with an on-duty firefighter. Once inside, the heat could be felt through my bunker gear. We were inside for maybe 5 to 7 minutes. Then air horns went off for everyone to exit the building. Once we exited, I proceeded to take off my SCBA and cool off a little bit. I didn't realize how hot it was inside the building until I went to take my helmet off and felt the heat through my gloves. I started to feel sick to my stomach and lightheaded. Other firefighters saw that I was starting to turn white and had stopped sweating. My body started to shake uncontrollably and I was blacking out. I was transported to a local hospital where I was treated for heat exhaustion. My lessons learned? I learned the importance of paying attention to the way my body feels when inside a structure fire or outside in the heat. Thinking about it afterwards, my stomach had started to feel weird while I was inside the building, and I was beginning to feel like I wasn't sweating. I also learned the importance of hydration.
Thanks, Christine. Well, it's pretty obvious here. The firefighter is submitted to some intense heat conditions during some summer months. As we all are probably well aware, once we start to sweat inside our turnout gear, there's no way for the heat to really actively be or positively be dissipated. So there are certain skills. There are certain tricks of the trade. There are certain ways you can monitor what's going on with the ambient temperatures out or around you when you're inside a structure. And among those are things like paying attention to what the smoke is doing before you enter the structure, keeping a conscious mind on what you've had to drink and eat over the course of the previous 24 hours. Also making sure that as we move into these periods that you do up your hydration. And after we finish today, we'll be talking a little bit more about some tips about what you can do to bring yourself up to the right level of hydration. Our final report review today is 06423. It was submitted in August 2006. It comes to us from a captain in a combination mostly volunteer department in FEMA Region 9. This event took place in July of 2006 at 0930 hours, and it's going to take a little bit of a different twist for us. Christine?
I was dispatched for an ATV accident with one patient in a dry riverbed. The weather is reported as 110 degrees in the river bottom. We followed a POV into the accident scene, approximately three-quarter miles from the staging area. The scene was located on a hillside about 200 feet up a 38-degree incline. We made a decision to set up a belay system and call for additional manpower, technical rope rescue equipment, and sports drinks. Two helicopters were launched and landed at the base of the hill, reporting 114-degree temperatures at the landing zone. After a delay, the patients were extricated to the base of the hill and flown to a Level 1 trauma center. The medevac pilot reported a takeoff temperature of 118 degrees. The extrication took approximately 1 hour. While we were demobilizing, two ambulance personnel became fatigued. One went unconscious while being helped on the hill. Six additional personnel were needed to evacuate the unconscious member. It took 45 minutes to remove the member from the riverbed to the original staging area. One additional member was treated for heat exhaustion. My lessons learned? Call for additional manpower. Ensure plenty of liquids are available for all personnel working on scene. Establish shade for incidents lasting more than 15 minutes in extreme temperatures. Use additional vehicles for shuttles. Use small ice chests to protect IV solutions and meds. Establish a safety sector immediately. Don't overburden the incident commander with multiple roles. Don't overestimate or underestimate weather conditions. Use time checks by dispatch and rotate crews as much as possible. Last, debrief and be honest.
Thanks, Christine. So as you can plainly see, that it's not just the fire ground where we can run into problems with hydration and heat exposure. The technical rescue event that we just reviewed also points to the fact that there are concerns that happen to us just from being out in the weather. So the keys to fending off heat exhaustion include sufficient hydration, frequent breaks from labor, getting out of your PPE as soon as possible, and moving out of the sun. All of those seem to be a common theme throughout everything that we did. With a little bit of research, we found out that there are some symptoms that can be related to percent body weight water loss, and these come to us from What You Need to Know About Hydration from Steve Bourne. You can visit www.ecaps.com for more information. But just as an example, when the body loses 4% of its water loss, exercise performance is cut by 20 to 30%. At 6% loss, weakness and severe loss of thermoregulation occurs. If you lose 7% of your body fluids, collapse will likely occur unless the exercise stops, which we've observed in a couple of our episodes of the event. And if you were to go as far as 11% of losing your body fluids, you'll end up with death. So effective rehab is really recognized as an increasingly important function on the fire ground. In my own department, we have a rehab unit that's dispatched when a working fire is announced, and that really is not necessarily temperature dependent, but it's even more frequently found in the summer months. During training, one of our critical preparatory functions on the at the drill ground is ensuring that there's plenty of water and electrolyte replacement drinks available. One of the things we note is that evaporative cooling depletes fluid levels and electrolytes faster than they can be replenished. So ironically, you can drink too much, and that's called overhydration, which is one of the things that was happening with that one instructor, where he was taking a 10-minute break and trying to put fluids back into himself, but the body just can't absorb the fluid enough to make a difference. The imbalance that can occur, that occurs, can have some dangerous consequences. So there's some research and data still being conducted for firefighters and hydration, but there's already a wealth of knowledge out there on hydration in circumstances that it can be likened a lot to fire ground and operational conditions for us. So as a rule of thumb, in order to get away from some of the problems of dehydration and heat stress, start hydrating before you start sweating. It sounds very simple, but basically maintain a fluid intake at a rate of about 8 ounces every 20 minutes during periods of heavy exertion. You can take your, if you're drinking straight water or you have a combination of water and electrolyte fluids, you can mix the two together for a 50-50 split, and that'll help with some of the absorption. You can augment the cooling process by using cold, wet towels, sponges, hose lines set to a light mist, and then there are certainly the misting outfits that are out there. The most important, I guess, point to remember is that no matter where you are in the country, you can be exposed to heat stress. Departments that handle it on a regular basis seem to be the best suited to take care of it, but it's incumbent on all of us to make sure we pay close attention to it. For more information about the hydration and some of the resources we use today, you can go to www.americansportsevents.com. You'll be able to see the full article from Steve Bourne. The goal of Near Miss Listen and Learn is to provide topical information you can use as part of your comprehensive safety program to improve firefighter safety by focusing on culture and behaviors. In several of the events we reviewed today, I think we noticed that there were certain behaviors that were exhibited by supervisors or people in leadership positions that create the scenario, or at least contribute to the scenario, that leads us to the path of injury. I'd like to thank you for listening to this edition of Near Miss Listen and Learn on radio at firehouse.com. If you have any suggestions on topics you would like us to focus on in our next installment or future installments, send me an email at jtippett, that's J-T-I-P-P-E-T-T, at iafc.org. For more information on the reporting system, visit www.firefighternearmiss.com. And again, we'd like to thank the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Assistance to Firefighters Grant Program for fully funding the National Firefighter Near Miss Reporting System. Fireman's Fund Insurance Company provided operating funds at the creation of the program. A special acknowledgement to Fire Chief Tom Carr from Montgomery County Fire Rescue for supporting me and the program as we move forward in improving firefighter safety. And thanks to Firehouse.com for making the podcast possible. Before we sign off of this edition, I want to remind you that if you had a near miss, it doesn't matter whether it was a recent or a past occurrence, submit your report to FirefighterNearMiss.com. The report you submit could help save a life of another firefighter on any given day. Until our next edition, stay safe and remember to listen and learn.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.